From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As soon as she reveals she studies religion practically wherever she is, even inside a taxi cab, the scholar Karen Armstrong gets one version of this proclamation. Religion has been the cause of all the major wars in history. Armstrong says just based on the facts alone, the statement is not true, but the perception persists for reasons that are complicated. And that's one of the takeaways from her book, that the things that motivate people to fight and kill are complicated. Today in the program, Armstrong is joining us. She says, of course, religious thinking has played a role in war, but so has politics, so has human nature. It all gets bundled up throughout history as people have struggled to make sense of the world. Karen Armstrong today, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot to get to if we're going to cover even a fraction of the history Karen Armstrong explores in her new book. Basically, it's 7,000 years of history as she compares belief practices over the centuries as a way of understanding the influence of religion on human violence. A basic impression has emerged over the years that religion is inherently violent, or that religious impulses, anyway, are to blame for most of the violence and the major conflicts in human history. And Armstrong says, yes, religion has played a role in warfare and suffering over the years, but she says this is not the whole story. If you push beyond what she says can be oversimplified assumptions about the nature of religion, you will find that the struggle for peace has been just as important as the Holy War. And just what do we mean by religion anyway? Armstrong says the modern concept is completely different from what people say 1,000 years ago or even 500 years ago would have said about religion. Karen Armstrong is joining us today to talk about her book. It's called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. Karen Armstrong has written extensively on religion. Her books include The Case for God, Muhammad, A Prophet for Our Time, and 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. She's joining us today from NPR member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. And Karen Armstrong, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've talked about this before as someone who speaks on religion, who studies it, writes on it. Explain what the mantra is that you hear over and over again, as you say, when you get in a taxi cab, for example.
Well, the cabbie will ask me what I do for a living. And when I tell him, he intones this phrase, you know, eerily in the same form of words every time. Religion has been responsible for all the major wars in history. I've heard this mantra repeated not just by taxi drivers, but by American psychiatrists and commentators and journalists and academics. This notion has become absolutely central to our Western secularized consciousness.
Where do you think the suspicion comes from? Is it just a misreading of history, or is there something in some ways maybe personal for people who may have been alienated or disillusioned from their own religious experiences?
Well, I've certainly had a difficult time with religion as a young woman. Mm. Certainly not as a nun. When I left my convent, I wanted nothing to do with religion ever again. Yeah. But then I discovered that you know, through writing and research, that religion, that I had a very parochial idea of religion. Now, this problem of religion and violence really goes back to the 18th century. Before the 18th century, it was impossible for people, conceptually impossible for people, to separate, say, religion from politics. Mm. Religion permeated all aspects of life. No other culture has anything like our view of religion as something separate from other activities that's a personal, private quest centering on a historical tradition and a supernatural God. There's no word in Greek or Latin that corresponds to our notion of religion. The Talmudic rabbis certainly wanted to bring the whole of life into the ambit of the sacred. And Jesus certainly would not have, or Muhammad would certainly not have seen it important to separate religion and politics, because, nor would the prophets of Israel, because the plight of the poor, the plight of the oppressed, were matters of sacral import. Mm. And the prophets had hard words for people who said their prayers nicely, but allowed for major injustice in society. And they would castigate kings for their war crimes as well as their crimes against their oppressed subjects. But in the 18th century, Europe and later the United States were developing a new form of society, of politics. The myth of religious violence, as it's been called, goes back to the so-called wars of religion of the 16th and 17th centuries, which were appalling wars. It was catastrophic violence that left about a third of the population of Central Europe dead. The myth was that these terrible wars that lasted over 100 years, culminating in the 30 Years' War, had been entirely caused by the quarrels of the Reformation between Protestants and Catholics. Now, certainly the participants did see these wars as religiously inspired, because religion permeated warfare as it permeated all other aspects of life. But if it had been entirely due to these theological disputes, we wouldn't expect to find in these wars Catholics and Protestants fighting on the same side. But in fact, they often did so, and as a result, killed and fought their co-religionists. Other factors were involved. These wars were also wars against two different kinds of state builders. One was the Holy Roman Emperor, who wanted to create a nation, an European-wide empire like the Ottoman Empire. And the princes and the kings of Europe were fighting against this. They wanted to create sovereign absolute states, and they were the ones who won. In 1648, you have the end of these wars, and Europe was henceforth divided into small sovereign states, each ruled by an absolute ruler with a professional army, and the church had to be subjugated, because the monarch had to be sovereign, and that meant he couldn't allow the church to, he had to control the church in his domain. And so just as religion was being pushed out from the centre of politics in Europe, so too the philosophers made a philosophy out of this. Yeah. And John Locke, the great early modern thinker, who separated religion and politics for the first time, and said that a peaceful society, it was essential that religion and politics were entirely separate. They had nothing to do with one another. Mixing them, he said, was like confusing heaven and earth. And then later your founding fathers here, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, also insisted that there must be a wall of separation between the church and the state. And that's been very, very beneficial for many of us, not least for religion, because when religion gets too closely identified with government, it inevitably gets caught up with the violence and inevitable injustice committed by the state.
Forgive me. I want to back up a bit because I do want to talk a little bit more about the separation of church and state.
Yes,
but I want to ask you about what you describe as the heart of the problem, and that is what we mean by religion. You were getting at it a bit there, but because you say the modern concept of "quote unquote" religion is idiosyncratic, it can be eccentric. But our modern concept of it as an objective thing, religion as objective thing, would have been very strange to people not so long ago. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, well, if you look at words that we translate religion in other languages, they invariably refer to something much, much wider, much more broad. For example, din in Arabic means a whole way of life, an entire way of life. And the Quran has no idea of a religious tradition that is exclusive and that everybody's got to belong to. That's the one true faith. It has no notion of that and no notion of politics, for example, being separate from religion. Similarly, dharma in Sanskrit applies to one's duty to the gods, but also to judicial problems, all kinds of political, economic problems too. No one would have had an idea of what you meant by religion,
right.
Because it was like to try to pick out religion from politics or warfare or state building would have been like trying to take the gin out of the cocktail.
Right.
It permeated, it pervaded all aspects of life, and certainly in China or India. Or Greece or Greek or Latin, as I've already said, had no word corresponding to our religion and religious.
Do you think this is our burden then, as Westerners, that we have this sense of literalism that doesn't seem to fit well into the larger story of religion, which has been, as you say, larger and vaguer and more encompassing? Is the fact that we're so literal when we think about an idea of religion, does that limit the way we see religion and its influence?
It certainly influenced the way we encounter other cultures, because we British, for example, when we founded our empire in the 19th century, we took this conception of religion with us, this new conception of religion, but it had no bearing on what the colonized peoples felt in the Middle East or in India, where the British influence was absolutely catastrophic. We British looked around this vast continent of multifarious people and said, you know, how are we going to rule this? And they divided them into religious traditions, which were quite alien. There were the Muslims, who had been the former rulers of India. There were the Sikhs, there were the Christians. And then there were this mass of the majority of people who had all been practicing their own quite separate devotions, had no unifying theology, no unifying scriptures. Everyone just did their own thing. Mm. And suddenly they found themselves all lumped together into something called Hinduism.
Yeah.
But the conquered peoples realized that if they wanted to gain the ear of the British, they had to pretend that they were speaking, like a pope or a bishop for a large number of people. They were represented a large body of people. And they had to adopt Western ideas of religion. And so the only religious tradition that actually fits our modern Western conception of religion is Protestant Christianity. Mm. And so you find the people of India, Muslim and the new Hindus and the Sikhs, all trying to create religion on the Protestant model and distorting their traditions completely. And inadvertently, therefore, the British bequeathed the whole history of communal religious violence to India, exacerbating these tensions that had not really existed there before.
Mm. I want to ask you about the kind of human nature part of the story that you tell. You mentioned how we are creatures who seek meaning. We're looking to invest everything with value. And you point out that we have this, you know, terrific capacity for wonder. And I wanted you to explain this, because you say in the book that we have always looked for opportunities to feel connected to what you call these extraordinary realities, and that this satisfies an essential craving. What do you mean, an essential craving?
Well, we human beings, we have what they call a neocortex, a thinking part of the brain that enables us to reason and think and reflect on our experience. Now, dogs, as far as we know, don't spend a great deal of time agonizing about the canine condition or about the plight of dogs in other parts of the world, or what will happen to them when they die. We humans, we have to live with the knowledge of our own mortality, and these problems of injustice and pointlessness plague us. And if we don't find some meaning in our lives, we can fall very easily into despair. And so we've always, from very, very early date, if you look at those cave paintings painted by our prehistoric ancestors in the Stone Age, 1700,000 years ago, we've always tried to invest our lives with meaning by means of art and religion. The two were absolutely mixed together, as you can see in those cave paintings. The first documented account of our species in those caves, which were certainly centres of cult, what we call cult and religion, but also wonderful artwork.
Warfare comes into play here too, because you describe that as one of the, as you say, the oldest triggers of ecstatic experience.
It is, for men, I think.
Yeah.
Because we men, for the vast part, you men rather, the vast part of your history, the longest period of our history was our period as hunter-gatherers, when we had to, when the men had to go out and learn how to use technology, use their big brains to create technology to kill animals much larger than themselves, because farming had not yet been invented, and they were dependent upon the killing and eating of animals, something that seems to have disturbed them, just as it deeply disturbs hunting-gatherer people today, who surround the hunt with ritual and feel profoundly uncomfortable about having to kill their fellow creatures.
So these are conflicting impulses going on in our...
They are, yes, very much so. They're thinking about this. When in the Kalahari, for example, where the Bushmen have to use very light arrows, they have to anoint them with a poison because there's not enough wood to create strong weapons. And they have these arrows that just graze the skin, anointed with poison that kills the animal very slowly. And the killer, the person who's killed the animal, has to sit with the animal while it dies, sometimes for days, crying when it cries, shuddering when it shudders, participating symbolically in its death throes. But yet, there's also, and soldiers will tell you this, there's also a great exhilaration that comes with fighting. Chris Hedges, former war correspondent for the New York Times, has written a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Yeah. That things seem intense. You realize when you're in the heat of battle how simple everything is. There's black, there's white, there's us, there's them. And the trivialities of ordinary life, the pointlessness of it, seem absolutely impossible when you come back on leave. Everything seems to lack meaning. And it gives them, as soldiers say, I quote a Vietnam veteran who said he hated what the war was about, but he loved the high that he got. And one of the hardest things about going back to peace is that he'll never again have that heightened sense of ecstasy, exhilaration. So we all seek these moments in our lives when we feel deeply touched within, but lifted momentarily beyond ourselves.
So is that what religion is designed to do in some ways, is to reconcile those impulses?
Indeed, and give our battles some meaning, just as our state buildings are given meaning. But there's also a real adrenaline rush for men in warfare. I was talking some weeks ago to a British military historian who said one of the big things that is driving young men to the battlefield throughout history has been boredom. A sense of pointlessness and weariness. And that, I'm sure, is driving some of these young men to join the ISIS fighters in the Middle East today.
Karen Armstrong is with us. Her latest book is called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. We need to take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the religion scholar Karen Armstrong is back with us to take on the idea that religion is to blame for wars and violence in the world. Armstrong says religion has played its part, of course, but understanding violence, she says, is so much more complicated, and blaming God or superstition is a misreading of history. Her book is called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. You point out that the human relationship with violence and warfare is complicated because it's a relatively recent development. You know, there is little evidence that early humans, you say, regularly fought each other. But then things change in about 9,000 BCE. And this is the era of agriculture, which you point out we often look back at, you know, with the agrarian age as being this wonderful, charming, nostalgic moment. But you say, in fact, it was a pretty cruel and traumatic time. And this is an important part of the story. Would you talk about this?
Yes, it is an important. That's why I call the book Fields of Blood.
Yeah.
Because we have this rather idyllic conception of ancestors who were living close to nature. And but agriculture was a fearsome struggle. And the big turning point came when a small group, and this happened first in Mesopotamia in what's now southern Iraq, people began to grow more food than they needed. And a small group managed to commandeer that surplus, take it away from the peasants, and use this wealth to build the first cities, the first civilizations. It was a terrible system. It meant that about 2% of the population, with a band of retainers, servants, bureaucrats, soldiers, etc., lived on the back of 90% of the population who were kept at subsistence level. Impoverished, basically. And this massive structural injustice in society, and every pre-modern society until the 19th century was based on this terrible system. Its warfare became essential to the agrarian economy. The only way to increase the wealth of your state was to get more land and more peasants to farm it. And that meant you were constantly fighting rival aristocrats for these things. And plunder was also an essential part of the economy. So all states, whatever their religious persuasion, were driven to first this structural injustice of suppressing the peasants, and in warfare, constantly to acquire more wealth in order to keep their civilized, fragile civilizations going. No one ever found an alternative until we industrialized the society, and industrialization became the basis of society rather than agriculture.
And you say that this systemic violence, we found it everywhere in the Middle East, in China, in India, in Europe, everywhere it was there. There was no way around it, as you say, until the modern era.
No, and no one ever found an alternative. And so it seemed like a sort of iron law of life. But from a very, very, very early age, you find people, poets, prophets crying out against this injustice. Earlier, I mentioned the prophets of Israel who were constantly crying out against the injustice done to the poor 90% of the population. And a very, very early poem written about 1700 BCE, as far as we know, a narrative poem written in ancient Mesopotamia, sees the gods crying out, themselves crying out against this injustice, saying this is unjust, but they cannot find another solution.
Well, but it's interesting you write about the Indian Emperor Ashoka, for example,
yes,
who tries to promote this ethic of compassion, but in the end, it's so telling because he cannot get rid of his army. He can't go all in,
yes,
on the idea.
You know, I wanted to call this book Ashoka's Dilemma, because this is Ashoka's dilemma is the dilemma of civilization itself. Ashoka was he lived in about the 3rd century BCE. He was the first emperor to rule the whole of India. And he was a cruel man. He'd come to the throne by killing two of his brothers. That's quite normal in Indian society at that time. But 8 years into his reign, he accompanied his army to put down a rebellious city. And he was horrified. He had a kind of conversion experience, horrified by the violence, by the mass deaths that his army had inflicted on the population. He was appalled to see 140,000 prisoners of war being taken away from their families, who were distraught families, for forced labour in other parts of the empire. And he put up massive inscriptions all over his huge empire, written on large towering rock faces and huge cylindrical pillars, calling upon kings to desist from warfare whenever possible. And if they have to go to war, to keep punishment and violence to a minimum.
Yeah.
He describes his extreme distress at what happened in this rebellious city. He says that everybody must live together peaceably. He himself, he said, is going to give up hunting, the sport of kings. It's too violent. He's going to replace this with royal pilgrimages to Buddhist shrines. He's going to build hospitals and clinics. And he calls upon everybody to live peaceably and listen to all the teachers, even those deemed heretical by the Brahmin priests, and listen to everybody's teachings with equanimity and to treat people kindly and compassionately. But as you say, he could never disband his army, because had he done so, all these wannabe emperors would have fought one another to the death, to succeed him. And, you know, so there would be more suffering, more violence, more bloodshed. And interestingly enough, in the pre-modern world, the best way to achieve peace was to create a strong empire that would keep these warring aristocracies constantly fighting one another for more land and more peasants. It would keep them, this violence, in check. And people looked eagerly for a strong empire, as eagerly as we look for signs of a flourishing democracy today, because it seemed the best way of keeping the peace. So Ashoka's dilemma, wanting to do the good thing, but knowing that if he disbands his army, there will just be chaos. Military historians tell us that without strong, disciplined armies, it's possible that human beings would never have just degenerated into warring hordes, or never achieved civilization at all.
You know, one of the things you explore in the book is the Hebrew Bible, which you describe as being different from some of the other texts that you write about, in that its heroes were not members of an aristocratic elite. And it's interesting, I wanted you to talk a bit about all of this, because when you look at how the Hebrew Bible, for example, originally came to these people, and then over the years it was kind of rewritten. There were all of these revisions that happened. And in the earlier version, there were no Ten Commandments, for example. That was kind of inserted later, which brings you to a jealous God later. And I wanted you to talk about that part, because you see this idea of this is how you put it in the book, cultic exclusivity. The idea,
yes,
of, I don't know if it's the first or the second of the Ten Commandments that says you
first
shall have no, first, no gods above me. That would have been profoundly strange for the time. Talk about how,
yes,
that comes into play in all of this.
It's very, because for us religious, we take religious exclusivity absolutely for granted,
right,
but this was absolutely not the case. And but at that moment, we're talking about the 7th century BCE, At this moment, Israel was surrounded by very, very powerful empires. The northern tribes had all disappeared. They'd been deported by the Assyrian emperor, little kingdom of Judah was terrified that it too would be obliterated. And constantly throughout the book, I show that when a society feels absolutely threatened like that by a great power, that's when their religion tends to reflect that fear and become much more sort of xenophobic and frightened. Certainly, the mythology of the Hebrews consisted of a single story of starting with Adam and Eve and going through to the Exodus from Egypt and Moses. But in the original, the Ten Commandments was not part of the story. Originally, the earliest texts, we see the elders having a vision of God on Mount Sinai with Moses. But in the 7th century, reformers felt that they rewrote this, and they rewrote a scripture. And this was not forgery in our sense of the word. It was quite common when people were trying to introduce new ideas to put them on the lips of a learned authority, in this case, Moses. And the book of Deuteronomy has Moses' last speech written by these reformers, in which he tells the Israelites that when they come into the promised land, they must kill all the indigenous inhabitants of Canaan. Now, before this, and right up indeed to the 3rd century, Israelites were continuing to marry with Canaanite women and taking part in their rituals. But now Moses says, if you do this, you will be destroyed. And that was this new exclusivity comes into the religion of Israel. Later priests, would revise what the Deuteronomists said and try to restore a much more peaceful, more inclusive vision. But those most violent parts of the Bible, which people always quote when they say that religion is violent, and something called monotheism is also violent, because it's intolerance. This was an aberration in Israelite history, and Israelites at this point were not monotheists. They believed, some of them believed, that you should worship only Yahweh, but the first commandment actually reads, "You shall not have strange gods in my presence." Now, the word presence, Shekhinah, referred to the presence of God in the temple in Jerusalem. And a previous king, Manasseh, had introduced a whole lot of effigies and of different gods. And the Temple of Solomon was full of pagan imagery.
And that God was okay with that as long as you didn't bring it into the temple.
God didn't mind that until the Deuteronomist said he did.
Yeah, right.
And then in the first commandment, "Thou shalt not have strange gods before in my presence in the temple." But still, long after this reform, there were still, as we know from the prophet Ezekiel, by this time deported to Babylonia, there's still the pagan imagery in that temple, because the idea of an exclusive religion had not yet taken root.
We should also point out, as you say, we need to head to a break here, but I wanted you to mention, you often hear the violent parts of the Hebrew Bible mentioned, but you point out these are not intended anyway to be morality tales. You have to read them as political philosophy. I think that's an important theme in your book.
It is, and certainly, look, if you think of the story of Adam and Eve, they fall out of the Garden of Eden. I don't think they fell into a state of original sin, as Augustine suggested. But they fell into an agrarian economy, as God said, the land will be blighted, and you'll have to work as field hands, with the sweat of your brow, you have to grow your food. And Cain, the first farmer, the person who builds the first agrarian city, is also the first murderer. So the Israelites are really, these early parts of the scripture are deeply critical of agrarian society. And the Tower of Babel is a very thinly disguised attack upon Babylon, with its towering ziggurats reaching up to heaven, and God destroys that. And in the Exodus from Egypt, God takes the people out from the slavery of the agrarian empire and says, now you will live not like the other nations, but live free with me. So it's political philosophy, but that doesn't mean it's all about politics, because politics was a deeply religious pursuit.
Well, this is something you mentioned when you talk about Jesus, for example.
Yes.
As you point out, that Jesus was born into the society that was traumatized by violence. And so in Jesus' mission, you say politics and religion were inextricable. And I think it's something that a point a caller has. Let me take a call before we actually get to this break. I wanted to hear from Kevin, who's calling from Smithfield, Utah. Kevin, you with us?
I would very respectfully disagree and state that it wasn't John Locke that ushered in the separation, but Jesus himself. There's one particular verse where Jesus, in response to Pilate talking about who is king, says that his kingdom is not of this world. Three times in one verse, the kingdom is within. And there's two verses earlier, way back in the Old Testament, where there's hints about this changing from the overlapping of the kingdoms, you know, physical and spiritual. Jonah refuses to leave and go convert the pagan Ninevites, and God sends him into the belly of a whale for refusing to convert the pagans. And when the Jews are captive,
Kevin, let me.
Those
were good examples. Let's. I think you've made your point. Karen Armstrong, you want to respond to that idea that somehow these were separations of religion and politics?
I think even the text even more strongly quoted with Jesus when he's shown the coin of the Roman tribute.
Render unto Caesar, right?
Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God. And this is often seen as separation of powers. But in fact, in the context of first century Galilee, there had been many, and Judea too, there had been many, many uprisings against the Roman Empire in that period, all of them based on the premise that the land of Israel belonged not to the Romans, but to God, and its produce belonged to God. So Jesus is saying, you know, look, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's. And there's very little to give back to Caesar's, because it all belongs to God. And that's why they all cry out with admiration, because he's got himself out of a very tight hole. Similarly, when he goes into the temple and throws over the money changers' tables, he wasn't. This was the incident that probably led to his death. He was not arguing for a more spiritual form of religion, as is often thought. The temple for 500 years had been the centre of the imperial administration of the various empires that had ruled Palestine, and the tribute collected in kind from the peasants, extorted and taken to Rome, would be stored in the temple. And Jesus is saying this, quoting the prophet, saying this is a den of thieves, and so. The verse that you quoted about my kingdom is not of this world is from the Gospel of John, which is the latest of the Gospels, and quite different in tenor from the other, with a different agenda. And that's the wonderful thing about the New Testament, is that it is, again, it's not exclusive. There's not just one gospel. There are four very different gospels, each with its own distinctive take upon Jesus.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll read a few emails when we get back from a break. Karen Armstrong is with us. Her book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. And we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Karen Armstrong. We're talking about her latest book, Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. Here's an email that comes from William, who writes, "Religion and cultural cults make believers more susceptible to commands that go against personal values and against best interests." He writes, "A belief in a reward for an afterlife surely helps many faithful engage in, quote-unquote, righteous acts that call for ultimate self-sacrifice. Religions that proclaim a monopoly on truth set the ground for manipulation of the faithful to do violence to unbelievers." Which is, I guess, a good segue in many ways to talk about, and we'll get to Islam in general, because the question of suicide bombing ultimately comes up.
Yes.
Maybe let's start there. Suicide bombing comes up as one of those extreme examples of religious fervor,
yes.
And perhaps that's what William was talking about. But you also point out revolutionary suicide was never a part of the Islamic idea or tradition until the late, 20th century, I think it was.
Yes, and suicide bombing was not invented by Muslims.
Yeah.
It was invented by the Tamil Tigers, who were adamantly opposed to religion. And until the Iraq War, the Tamil Tigers held the undisputed record for the number of suicide bombers. Similarly, Robert Pape, a scholar at the University of Chicago, has made a study of every single suicide bombing that took place between 1980 and 2004, and concluded that it really has nothing to do with religion, certainly nothing to do with Islamic fundamentalism. In Lebanon, for example, they found that only about 7 of the 30 or so suicide bombing incidents were committed by Muslims, 3 were committed by Christians, and the rest were committed by secularist Baathists and socialists from Syria. And the thread that runs through all suicide attempts, and also in Israel-Palestine, has been the occupation of a country which people believe to be their homeland by a superpower with a massive army. So the invasion of the homeland is the key that runs through all this. And because there is such asymmetry, they feel they have to resort to these dreadful, unconventional methods.
Well, you also write about the images that they see of Muslim suffering throughout the world has been a powerful motivator. All of that beside the point of religion, at least from your perspective, this is something nationalistic. This is something empathetic, I suppose you could even say.
Yes. Well, the Quran tells Muslims that they must look after one another. And, of course, modern media makes it possible for Muslims all over the world to see the suffering, especially during the 1980s when this came to the fore. There was a lot. There were the terrible massacres of Sabra and Shatila in Lebanon, for one example, or the constant bulldozing of houses of Palestinians in Israel. Now, a survey has been done of the young Saudis, people of Saudi Arabia, who went first to join the jihad against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and then went to fight in Chechnya and Bosnia, and later join Al Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
He found that in every instance, the overriding concern was for the suffering that the Saudis were seeing in their every night on their television. I've seen some of these propaganda videos, and that you see these piles of corpses in Chechnya. You see these the Palestinian children being harried by Israeli soldiers or shot by Israelis. People in hospital, blinded and maimed, and this sort of collage of pain. This certainly infused. Bin Laden was able to exploit this in a disgraceful way, and what they found too was that in almost every case, it was sympathy for the victims that impelled these young men to go and try and help, as they say, their brothers and sisters, but not initially hatred of the oppressors. There was very little anti-Americanism. But the anti-Americanism seems to have occurred in the training camps of al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And in fact, six young Muslims from Buffalo, New York, left the camp because they were so shocked by the anti-Americanism that they encountered there. So suffering. And I think the tragic thing about the Iraq War was that we just sent out a whole new slew of images of Muslim suffering worldwide.
Abu Ghraib.
And similar pictures also from the British controlled prisons. And for this, the West was not only implicated, but also directly responsible. And so one of the things, if we want to sort of, I'm sure that this is a factor in the decision of many young people coming to join the jihad in Syria and Iraq today.
So do they think about an afterlife? I mean, clearly you hear about this idea of martyrdom and the gifts that will come in paradise. But do you think that's a real factor, or is this...
These stories about the afterlife and all these virgins that they're going to have, these are very, very latent, iffy and dubious traditions that have been certainly exploited in the recruitment of young people. But if you listen to the martyr videos of Hamas, where these young people, before Hamas has now abjured suicide bombing, of course, since 2005, but they segue. It's what I'm saying again, that religion is not the soul. It's implicated, but it's never the sole cause. These young men and women, they segue very easily and spontaneously and naturally from today I'm going to meet the Lord of the Worlds into a nationalistic cry for the liberation of Palestine, then into a third world ideology. Where they say they are going to going to be beacons and exemplars for all the suffering people who are suffering at the hands of the West. Then back to the liberation of Palestine, back to Allah. It's the cocktail I mentioned earlier, with all these different motivations: nationalism, third world ideology, blending with some belief in an afterlife. And you have to remember that many of these kids, living in Gaza, for example, in a refugee camp, this life held out very little hope. And researchers found that many of these young men, and then talking to survivors of attacks, said one of the chief motives was, again, to give their lives, which seemed utterly pointless and hopeless, some kind of meaning, because by dying a heroic death for the fatherland. And after all, it's no longer respectable to die for your religion, but it's admirable to die for your country. They also got that nationalistic fervor, new fervor that came in with the nation state in the 19th century, that to die for the fatherland was a wonderful way to go.
I want to ask you about, I want to get to two more things I'm anxious to before we end. So let me start with the nature of secularism, because this is something you write about. Because you say secularism has not exactly always offered an alternative to religion as far as reconciling conflicts or promoting peace. They had their own kind of streak of ruthlessness as well. And one of the things you say is that secularism did not displace religion, but what it did, ironically enough, is create new religious enthusiasms.
Yes. First of all, I mean, just look at his. I'm not pleading for a theocracy. Secular separation of church and state enabled us in the West to go for modernity, but in other parts of the world, it has got a very bad reputation. We've had two world wars fought not for religion, but for secular nationalism, and massive loss of civilian life there. In a place like the Middle East, secularism has been imposed so violently by reforming rulers who want their countries to look modern, that it's surrounded with a nimbus of absolute evil. The Shahs used to make their soldiers go out with their bayonets, taking off the women's veils in the streets because they wanted their countries to look modern, to look European. In 1935, Shah Reza Pahlavi gave his soldiers orders to fire at hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in one of the holiest shrines of Iran who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western dress. And so if one of your hundreds of Iranians died that day, and Sunni fundamentalism developed in the hideous prisons in which the Muslim Brotherhood were interred by Nasser in the 1950s and 60s. So secularism has its own violence, and it's often pushed religion into a more violent mode. As every fundamentalist movement that I've studied in Judaism, Christianity and Islam is rooted in a profound fear of annihilation. And when you think of the Shah with the shooting on those unarmed demonstrators, you can see that this is not just paranoia.
Let me ask you this finally. One of the things you mentioned, you don't want to live in a theocracy. Of course, that's obvious.
No.
But you've talked about the damages that have come from some secularist societies, wounding the psyches of people who, as you point out, are unprepared to be wrenched from ways of living and understanding that had always supported them. So do you think modern Western secular society should be willing to grant religion more of a place in public life, finally?
Yes, I do. Because for many, what you have in these developing societies is a small elite who've had a Western education, understand Western ideas. The vast majority do not. And there's great inequity, as we know, as in any modernizing country. There's inequity in our own countries, let's forget. Everybody is going to go modernize the way we did. I think that's the thing. And we have to be a bit more flexible about this, realizing that supporting rulers like the Shah, Mubarak, Ataturk, who closed down all the madrasas, forced the Sufi members underground, and it seems like a destruction of people's sacred values, and that can only breed distress and even animosity.
Karen Armstrong, her book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. She joined us from NPR member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Karen Armstrong, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KEWR News. The program is directed by technical direction today from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Michael Shea. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.